And I'm curious what you think the what you think is behind the question. How do seminaries, congregations, and pastors shape a ministry? Would anybody be bold enough to paraphrase the question? Or what do you think this is about tonight?
Say it again.
That's why we came.
How do seminaries, congregations, and pastors shape a ministry?
How do seminaries without pastors to affect congregations?
Okay. That's one of the concerns in the question, because a lot of congregations worry about what kind of pastors they get. I think some of the seminarians wonder how they're going to turn into pastors when they're in a seminary, and some of the seminary professors wonder how they're going to turn into pastors. How do seminaries, congregations, and pastors shape a ministry?
How does what get done really get done?
Can you say that again?
How does what really happens and what happens? Are we saying a church has a ministry? Is it the church's ministry, or is it actually the pastor's ministry in that church? Is it one man's ministry, or is it the entire congregation's ministry? Or is it something imposed on the congregation from a larger church? You will adopt this goal. This is your ministry. You take it on. But we have no Indians in our community. Well, kind of a thing.
Some of the conversation, some people who shared in forming the question preferred not to have a ministry, shape ministry. So it could go in that direction. Some of us preferred to have a ministry, and we were thinking sort of about the tasks, particular tasks, and concrete shape to a ministry, whether it be the ministry of the pastor or the ministry of the pastor and the congregation together. Any more comments on what you hear with the question? How do seminaries work? What do seminary faculty hope for from the dynamics of seminary life? What kind of expectations do young adults who are at seminary have for the seminary and for themselves? One of the interesting things about the village is that there are a number of people who have been through seminary or have spent some time in seminaries. Some of them are pastors, some of them are doing other kinds of work in ministry. Then there are a lot of us who really simply care about the seminaries because we care about the church. And we care about the ministries, and we really just care to know. We are interested in knowing what goes into how the work of the seminary relates to the ministry of pastors and the congregation.
It seemed to me that first question, compared to seminary, is how you select students for the seminary. It's a beginning process. Sometimes the results on the other end are questionable.
It's a good question. That's a good question. And you may really want to pursue this a little more. Just one other central question, and that's there's a lot of concern about not simply pastors in seminaries, but pastors in congregations. There are a lot of times where we are in a situation where we wish something really alive would happen, And we don't know how to help the pastor have it happen. And there are situations where pastors are frustrated in not being heard in the congregations. What does a congregation do about a pastor's ministry? Whether it's when it's not ministering. What does a pastor do about a pastor's ministry when it isn't ministering?
Well, is it fair to lay all that on the pastor? Isn't it the congregation's ministry?
Or
is it both their ministry?
The installation service in my first parish, the district president didn't preach to me, he preached to the congregation and told them that they were going to make me into a minister. And they sort of did. Do you have anything to, do you want to clarify the question?
I'm listening to try to figure out what the question is too. At least there's one theme that kind of comes up again and again here is just what in fact is the minister of a church and what he's supposed to do. And that relates to what his ministry or her ministry is as over against everybody's ministry in that congregation. How do you differentiate? What is the role of the one who for some reason gets paid for being there? And then when you talk about what that person is supposed to do, then how do you prepare somebody to do that? Or how do you find the right person? And then find the right person and encourage them to do it? And then when they come to a school to learn how to do it, what do you do to help somebody learn whatever it is you need to do to be a good pastor?
How do you identify what it is that makes someone a good pastor that you can teach in the seminary?
Yeah, well, look, that's part of the question. I think one thing that maybe the seminary would do better with somehow is getting feedback from people sitting in the pews about what makes a good pastor. It's true, of course, that you cannot make a purse out of a sow's ear, or however that thing goes.
You have no faith.
You get too much experience. I almost get the feeling sometimes that the people who are good religious leaders, that somehow it comes with the genes, that there's a kind of quality about them. And in fact, in some religions and other places, in fact, that's what happens. Somebody emerges and they are selected. Whereas we send kids 22 years old out of college to seminary and they don't know what life's about. And maybe they ought to go to Holden Village for a while first, like some of these people who kick around for a few years.
Aren't there certain general roles that they learn in the seminary that apply to all ministers? When they go into a congregation, then they have to learn some more specific roles applicable to that congregation. The congregation varies, so they have to be pretty adaptable, pretty adjustable, pretty sensitive to the congregation.
That's a good question. I'm not even sure that a pastor should be so sensitive to the congregation is, I think that the pastor should be sensitive to the Bible and make the congregation sensitive to the Bible instead of the other way around, because I get so often the impression that if the congregation is responsive to the pastor financially, then the pastor tries to please his congregation and never lays it on when it's needed.
Well, financial is only one aspect. There's many more roles than that.
Another problem with the pastor is that there really are pastors and pastors. There's a pastor for the old and a pastor that should serve the young and a pastor that should serve people in the hospital, and there's the pastor that's the great preacher, and there's the pastor that's the great comforter, and the pastor this and the pastor that. And I think it's just like with a good teacher, you can't be everything to everybody. And I guess a pastor should recognize what his calling really is and find that place in his life rather than fit his work to the congregation, because then he will not do himself justice, neither will he do justice to the congregation.
I think that's an extremely interesting comment. That's an absolutely fascinating comment about the finding some kind of particular shape to your own task and identity.
I think one of the problems we run into is that almost everybody has a different idea of what the pastoral ministry is. And this is a problem in training pastors, and this is a problem in how people respond, because everyone thinks, hey, this is the mold the pastor should have. And so you've got a congregation of 1,000 different molds that they expect. So maybe only slight differences in some cases, but there's so many different molds. And then you see pastors, on the other hand, that are good pastors who are very different, in very different molds. It's an extremely complex.
I think your comment about what I would call a lack of consensus about what the church wants in a pastor and what pastors ought to be, it's probably more diffused than it was in the past. And this makes it more difficult both for a person who wants to minister and for a congregation and for a seminary.
I have a comment or two to make about this issue, and I have to say, first of all, that I'm not a physician or doctor, but one way that I understand problems is by comparing them with a different area. What I hear here tonight about pastors is no different than the problem that the doctors are beginning to face, physicians, and the problem that they have in terms of what the medical schools are preparing physicians to be. And this comes from a physician himself who's criticizing medical school training, namely that by and large they give him all this biochemical and orthomolecular stuff, and they train them in processes which are specific, and then they send them out to be physicians. But then when they meet their congregation, namely us sick people, we have different needs, which were really never were taught in their schools. On the other hand, the physicians say that the congregation, the patient, should assume responsibility for his condition coming to the doctor, and not just go over there and say, hey, doc, I'm sick. What can you do for me? I hear somewhat the same thing in terms of what the congregation may be saying to the pastor, you know, okay, yep, getting into this domain of, you know, of heaven or whatever it may be. And where is the responsibility, whether it's the pastor's responsibility or the congregation's? Then the crucial question which was raised is, what is each one doing? You know, what are we doing? What is the minister doing? What we're supposed to be doing, which is very vague. And it's always vague. But I see a comparable situation in the field of medicine, which is just becoming to become aware of. But by and large, people are dissatisfied with the service that they get in that field. I don't know if it bears any relation to what is being said here, but it's a thing to look at to understand the problem in a wider perspective.
In a doctor, you want somebody who knows something about medicine, obviously. You got to know how to diagnose an illness and what medicine is prescribed and all that. But it helps if you've got a bedside manner, or you feel like you're being treated as a human being, or somebody understands more than the symptom or something. So I think in that sense, we do have those two sides of the art of pastoring, that you darn well better know something. But there's also this other kind of dimension of whatever it is. It involves your faith, it involves your maturity, your relationships to people. And I think at some seminaries, at Luther, for example, we've done pretty well with imparting the knowledge, although some would say we should do better with that. And I think we've tried the other, but I think that's the really difficult part. The quality of the person who's the pastor. Not just what that person knows. And how do you teach that?
I've never been in a church where there was any open line of communication, either filling out a questionnaire or classes to discuss or what, as to what the pastor, what was expected of the pastor by the congregation and what was expected by the congregation of the pastor. I would think that would certainly wouldn't solve all the problems, but it should help clear the air.
Usually this is always left to the elders to determine what pastor is going to be selected. And if they are satisfied with this incoming new individual, then he's presented to the congregation, and the congregation is before the congregation lays the man. And then he say, all in favor of saying aye. There's never a question. And it's bothering me very much, because I think that the people are themselves at fault if they get stuck with the situation, people or whatever, if they never discuss anything, they have never the gully to speak out when it's time. They always say yes, because they always feel that those few elders in church, whoever they are, some sort of important people in the church, business people with money, people who have run the church for who knows how long, and they will in the long run be the one who is determined, who are determining who the new pastor is going to be. And you find out once he's there on the pulpit, and you better like it, because he's with you with the next 5 years or 10 or 20 or whatever.
Let me ask a question. I want a show of hands on how many of you think congregations should be able to fire their pastors.
Are you talking about a majority vote?
No, I'm just taking a straw vote.
Majority vote of a congregation, is that?
Yeah, I mean, the congregation decides.
Maybe 2/3 or 3/4 or something.
How many of you think congregations do fire their pastors? Okay.
This is, on the other hand, of a very dangerous tool in all this firing business, because you might fire the man who says what you ought to know and don't like what you hear, you know, and the pastor is that only individual, as far as I'm concerned, that should have the right to tell you what you don't like to hear.
One of the criteria for a prophet in the Old Testament is that this is the person who can give a message that is unexpected and is uncomfortable. But it's interesting that in the Old Testament, it's not the priests who get to be, the priests couldn't do this. They were really caught up in the establishment, and there was a special order of bearers of the word who may have been priests and may not have been, but who had somehow didn't have to carry the offerings all the time, so that it remains, I think, from the perspective of the biblical text, it remains a very open question whether that kind of strong truthfulness is something that can be guaranteed or protected, and have we been, you know, so that we wanted this in our congregations. We protected the pastoral office so that the pastor could not be, this kind of word would be heard, but I guess some people wonder whether the way we've done it has really been effective or something. John, were you going to say something?
I have a strong opinion about how congregations feel about the pastor. I've never been in a congregation yet. One I grew up in, where anybody in the congregation felt that the pastor was one of their number in the job, just as their jobs were to be bankers or mechanics or whatever, was to be the pastor of that congregation. That the pastor was somebody removed. I mean, he came from another world. somewhere.
He does. It comes from another world.
And the congregation basically in general raised a pool of money together to have a person in their midst who was on call at 24 hours for whenever they needed them to perform certain ritual functions on Sunday, variety of other things, but that person was not somebody they felt was in their midst, was a friend and fellow, part of the community and part of their life. And I don't know whether this was ever different in the past, but I think it causes a lot of the problems with our demands on pastors to come and somehow live in solitude and, you know, with his wife and his children who he's trying to raise, and yet somehow lead a community or of the faithful. In which that community denies him, you know, access to all the rights and privileges of fellowship and support.
How many of you view your pastors or see yourself in a congregation as in some sense isolated from the congregation? Okay. Warner, you...
I think that, you know, as amongst the clergy themselves, as they demand to be, right to say, treated as normal people, comparing themselves to the corporation and to the industry, even in terms of benefits, salaries, and so forth. But I think, on the other hand, then, that the laity within the church is going to say, well, you know, you can't have that side without the other side of the corporate function, too. In other words, that, you know, you're getting back to the idea of firing a pastor or dismissing a pastor. And I think that, you know, that's starting to close in now, where on one side there should be equality, but where do you stop the equality? And then is the corporate model going to set the model for the clergy, too, and for the church? I'm not sure that it should. But as there is a demand on one side for equality, well, I think the laity and the church and the only knows maybe the one side is going to say, well, then there's got to be equality on the other side, too.
Well, that's happened a long time before they paid the money. My grandfather was fired because he had leukemia.
What?
I mean, it's not a matter of whether you get paid or not. Congregations can be just as small-minded in the 1890s and 1920s as they are today. I think it's a handy thing to say that, well, they're getting paid now, so we should make them more answerable.
You know, the model generally now for the salary structure in the church, they're likening it to the salary structure in schools. They're saying that a pastor is in a comparable position to a principal of a school, and therefore the salary structure should be there. I think that, and also even in terms of the ownership of houses instead of parsonage, well, all those things I think are changing, and not that they're not right, but I think as those things change, well, then the attitudes of the congregation towards the pastor also change.
All right. We borrow one or another kind of piece of a model from some other profession or some other community, and maybe we don't want the whole model. And do we have to buy the whole model? Paul, can you spell out what you were talking about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in this district, a pastor starting gets paid $9,700 a year or something. That's not very much. It's 1977. And we're talking about corporate models or something. It's not a lot of money. I mean, you know, and suddenly congregations are saying, whoa, you're getting paid close to $10,000 a year. Where are we living?
This depends on the congregation. Let me tell you, our pastor gets at least 3.5 times that much.
Okay, I'll admit. Our pastor does. But I'm not knocking either side. I just don't want to get into the fact that I think the pastors are demanding a decent salary. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think for too long, I mean, I grew up in a pastor's household, and my father made, you know, $5,000 a year.
If a congregation were to be making some sort of judgment about dismissing a pastor, as a lot of you raised your hands, for what reason would you do that? What kind of quality is it that would so...
Well, I think most congregations buy and sell ministers like baseball clubs do baseball. But I think most congregations who can afford it, all congregations in the first place, want a pastor who can do the things that they can't do themselves, and that's live off of nothing, and be morally upright at all times, and like John said, on call 24 hours a day. And they can't do it. Nobody in the congregation can do it. So they buy a pastor, you know, who they think can do it. And I think congregations also, you know, they fire pastors too. If for some reason he falls short of whatever, they don't come out and say you're fired. You know, they go about it in very Christian ways.
They pray for it.
Yeah, they still do away with it. You know, like for myself, like being black in the Missouri Senate, I can't go every place, you know, and get a job. And even some of the ones, you know, some of my white peers who I go to classes with, you know, most congregations ask for some, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, good student, you know, who's 6'2" or whatever, you know. And if they don't get them, then they'll just wait and buy another one. Those who can afford it. Those who can't afford it, get whatever they can, you know, and just pray and hope that he doesn't get wise and walk away.
The model of the executive has been pretty influential, so that you really want a pastor who can increase the membership. Second row, yellow shirt.
You fire a pastor, or you do fire a pastor, but it seems to me that there should be some mechanism by which a pastor could be moved at an appropriate time. I'll give you an example. I belonged to one church one time, and the pastor was, he always got calls. He was an excellent pastor every week. And the congregation didn't want him to leave. Well, after about 5 years, he finally left. I was in another church where the pastor had been there for 15 years, and I understand he never got a call. He was a real nice fellow. The church was in a growing area, but the church didn't grow. Every time we got a new member, we lost a whole one. And it just wasn't moving. He just wasn't the man for the area. Now, somehow or other, there should be some mechanism by which the bishop or somebody could look in there and say, hey, we got to move him out and move somebody else in, rather than have the congregation stand up and vote for the pastor. But apparently there isn't anything that accomplishes this.
That's where the Methodists have the answer. They rotate up every 7 years.
Yeah.
Used to be three. They figured at the end of 3 years a man had made so many enemies, they
not all the time. Well, that's
until they get to big churches.
I hear a lot of comments around here tonight, and somehow it sounds more like discussion than reality to me. We may live in a utopia, and I don't think so. I find the firing of a pastor or something like that a very difficult thing for a congregation to go through. We have not gone through that, but we've had some neighbors that have, and it's been very traumatic for the people involved in that church. But I think one of the things which breeds dissatisfaction is a lack of a failing in the teaching, whether it's in the pulpit or in other programs that he may bring. And I think that's what the laity lack, is the time, the experience, to have a very strong background, a biblical background. You have a surface, and maybe some have a strong background, but when you don't get that, or when you get the preaching in difficult subjects, or the, like you're talking about prophecy or whatever, I think a lot of congregations, a lot of people can take that if it's well-founded, but if it is just flippant or faddish or something that is not strongly based
and there hasn't been a strong education to show why that is true, or why that is proper, or why that is sin, or whatever, then I think the congregations get dissatisfied. And if that goes on and you get pablum, or you get nothing exciting in the church for a period of years, I think pastors are fired. And I don't, those are nice people, but they're not getting the job. And I think it's a very important thing for the seminaries to make sure that the strong educational background is there, so that they have the equipment and tools to do that. And I don't.
Lund?
And I don't.
Lund?
Hey, do we not, let's say, basically in our theology, is it not possible for a congregation to flourish, to grow, to be strong, even in the absence of a pastor? I'm saying, where's the center of ministry?
Yeah, how can a pastor fire a congregation?
Sometimes moves away from the congregation. Who can stand them?
Well, what I'm asking is, whose ministry is it? Is it the pastor's ministry? Is it the pastor's responsibility to be on an ascending, a continuous ascending level of membership? And why do we want members?
That's a good question. Whose ministry is it?
I have a related comment to that, and I think an example of the church I was in, where I had to move away from the community, but there got to be a great deal of problem. And that was, I think the pastor forgot whose church it was. It was a new pastor that came in, and he decided that it was his church, and said as much in some council meetings that I sat in, and said, in effect, told members of the council that, listen, if you don't want to do it my way, you get off the council. And instead of remembering, you know, that it was God's church, and to me, in that kind of circumstance, the man shouldn't have been there.
That's a comment that I would like to say something. Yeah?
Go
on. I think that we all think of the most successful pastor as of that individual, this individual, who is intuitively able to fit himself to the congregation. If you happen to be in a congregation that is basically very traditional, etc., you better have that type of a pastor in order that this fellow fits the image of the lifestyle of all these people in general. If this very traditional individual moves into a congregation that is very liberal or easygoing and moving a little bit more away from the traditional interpretation of the Bible, these two will not fit. And I think it is important that as a congregation you kind of look well before you hire into the background of this individual that is coming, because you cannot expect this pastor to change his way of life and thinking so that it fits your lifestyle. If you happen to be a congregation that is all Norwegian, basically a traditional or at least a moderate, etc., you should not look for a man that doesn't have that background. And if you do get that kind of an individual, you cannot expect that you two will get along well. And therefore I say the congregation should be well looking into the pastor before he or she gets them. Not later on fire him because he doesn't fit you. You haven't been looking well for that individual. And I think this is a business that the congregation should take at heart and not leave up to three or four people that maybe not looking that well. For instance, the congregation I come from, they want definitely a pastor who can sing well. If he cannot sing well, I guess he is out. He has to have the ability to be very traditional, to bring forth where our background, where the background of the community comes from. If he has that, this is another real plus point for him. We are a downtown church, a growing downtown church. Our pastor is a man who is important, for whom it is important that we are going to get always new members, that the downtown church isn't dying out. if you have an individual who is a businessman, and the pastor has to be a businessman in our thing, then he has another plus point. If he is not that, out, this man hasn't gotten a chance. And there are these points that the congregation should look in, this and this we expect from the pastor, and then we look the individual who fits the criteria, not the other way around, and that's my opinion.
I think it's very good in the American Lutheran Church. I think a lot of people have realized that, and there has developed a thing called MIS, a Ministry Information Service, mm-hmm. where the pastors have written in information about themselves, what they'd like to do, what they don't like to do, all about them, things that they want to talk about in the call procedure, and things like that, that the congregation can find out ahead of time and discuss all of that, because it's very important to talk about them.
Yeah. Over the years in the congregations that I've been associated with, I think the members have been very generous in their accepting the pastor's great knowledge or lack of knowledge in the theological area. But I do think, and this is something we may not have covered much tonight, at least I haven't heard it, and I think they expect and have a right to expect the pastor to meet the requirements of the constitution of that church. For example, they can't expect the pastor to be on church on time. They can expect him to visit the sick. And if a person requests a pastor to come and pay a call on a friend or a family member, that the pastor should do this. He has basic requirements that should be met, must be met, just as it is true in a business field that a man's got to do a job. If you can't do the job, you find somebody to do it. And I don't think it's just in the area of theology. I think it's that the pastor is expected to be a concerned human. And this is a problem that I've seen occasionally in the Lutheran Church in America, of which I'm a member. And I kind of wonder if the seminary is directing, if they can, or assisting these seminarians as they leave the seminary to know that they have other duties besides just the Sunday morning job.
I would certainly think so. I mean, they've all interned, and I would certainly think so. I worry sometimes they're not concerned enough for the Sunday morning job. My own particular bias has been expressed well by the gentleman by the piano. I think that, and with some congregations I've been connected with, that it seems to me almost number one on people's list when they start talking about that perfect pastor and making this thing, is somebody who's a great preacher, who can really interpret the scripture, who knows what the Bible is and can talk about it and relate it to people's lives, who can preach and who can teach. I think it's also true, somebody over here said, that they'll forgive a lot of that if it's somebody they like, but they won't be excited, they won't get turned on by anything. And my bias is that the pastor, you know, all this business about roles and you need this kind of pastor and that kind of pastor and this kind of congregation, it seems to me that your business is in fact to know something about Scripture, to be able to talk theology, to talk about religion with people, publicly and privately. To be a preacher, a teacher, and a spiritual counselor, that's what it's all about. I think, that's my idea, is we're preparing people to be pastors. And I don't care how nice a guy you are, that's not going to carry you far enough unless you are able somehow to deal with the symbols of our faith and interpret them to people.
Do I hear you am I hearing right if you say then that the pastor is an interpreter of the symbols of the faith?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was thinking right along that line that, first of all, the minister should be prepared to bring the gospel, no matter where he's at or whatever. That's the first preparation. Then after that, I think there has to be a sensitivity to the congregation. In other words, over in Puyallup, there's a congregation with 2,000 members. Certainly a pastor in that congregation, head pastor, is going to be of the executive model. I mean, 2,000 people, you just can't know them all personally, you know? Okay, in that sense, you know, he preaches high masses and And a lot of that stuff, well, I'm assuming that they have an assistant pastor too, you know, which, but then there's got to be other people, there's got to be, you know, maybe groups, the cottage meeting type things, or Bible study groups or something like that, where the koinonia comes in, you know. But certainly a minister can't, in that size, can't be that intimate. As you take down now in Lakeview, Oregon, there's a congregation down there of about, well, I don't know, 15 people, you know, something like that. Maybe it's a little more than that. But the guy's called on a worker priest situation, you know, obviously they have to call somebody in that stance. But those farmers down there too are, you know, what better way is he going to minister to his congregation and have outreach out of that congregation than to go out and work with those people? You can't go out and work with 2,000 people, though. So it's a sensitivity to where your congregation's at and where the minister's at, too. In other words, and I ran into this very thing. We called a guy from Seminex, because I was in a congregation where 7 families left Missouri City. We called a fellow from Seminex, and he's the best, I mean, he is really sharp in interpreting scripture. He really is good at the gospel, you know. But he is an absolute computer. He comes through with all this stuff, but he doesn't know anybody sitting out there. And when there's only 10 people sitting out there, you know, you can get very close, you know, and ask some very personal questions. And we did that, you know, during our sermon. And a lot of, and during his sermon, we'd ask questions, you know, and stuff, in our houses. And yet, sometimes he wouldn't even hear us, because he was so programmed to that mass. I felt the seminary was programming these men to insensitivity of where they're at in the congregations. Now, this is just one of a couple, 3 incidences.
I hear some of you talking about particular things, some kinds of particular expectations of congregations, a particular concern for the pastor as interpreter, as a pastor, as bearer of the gospel. And the other thing that I hear is a concern about flexibility, that somehow there are situations where pastors and congregations are not interacting, are not really reacting them. Jennings?
2 things. One, I think St. Paul says someplace that this, and I heard of one of my friends installed in this message, that the pastor is called to be equipper of the saints for the ministry. And the other thing is that the seminary gets human beings from the congregations, and they're as different as each one of us sitting here. They have their strengths and their weaknesses, and you can't demold them by some miracle at a seminary to all of a sudden fit into a situation that goes against what they were as it came. Then that type of miracle doesn't happen in a seminary. You can't blame it on a seminary. And the congregation itself does shape a ministry in what they expect from a pastor, as far as the pastor's ministry goes. Because each one of us looks for something, and when it isn't there, then he's dissatisfied. And I remember my home pastor saying that when he went into the first call, he had some definite ideas what he thought he should be accomplishing as a minister. And somehow I haven't heard this part of it tonight, that as he he looked back at his first year, he looked on what he thought he should have accomplished, and he found that he had failed on all counts. But he went to an older pastor in the area and talked to him about it, and then he said, go back and see what the Holy Spirit has done to the preaching of the Word. And then he went back and he saw that the Holy Spirit had been.
John, are you still in line to say something? Gene?
I just want to ask a question. In the in the home office where the brownie points are tallied up, what are the main pluses for a pastor? I would think that it would be the increase in membership in a church, whether or not they had a successful building program. In other words, in what way can the powers that be evaluate the services of a pastor, his track record? If a man is ambitious, this is what he's going to aim toward, right? Wrong? What?
Is there anybody here from the district or Senate staff that knows? I think that your business about numbers and so on is probably thought of as an indication. But I don't think that all those people are quite so naive that their district presidents and synod presidents know that there are some churches that are not going to add a lot of members. I think they would know from their own contacts with people what a little bit about the kind of minister that person is on committees and meetings. I think that there would be feedback from congregations in one way or another. I'm sure a bishop or president has contacts that let him know what's happening in different places. Perhaps one thing that we should have more of is a kind of out in the open kind of evaluation where congregations talk to pastors about what they think about what they're doing. And it may not have to go out of that congregation to bishops or so on, but I've been kind of struck with the idea here that there really is a lot of dissatisfaction with pastors. You know, I hear that kind of thing coming.
Well, my first remark, I don't think there's any setup in the church for this kind of communication. And then all of a sudden the pastor's either sick and tired of the congregation or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is because we've never established a way of getting at what is expected of either the congregation or the pastor. There's been nothing set before he starts. There's been no evaluation at 6 months or at a year. And sometimes all he hears are just the people who talk the loudest.
There's a real issue here about somewhere between a kind of cold, calculating, industrial evaluation that you run people through the computer every 6 months or something. Because and a lot of people, pastors are really going to resist that because they talk about their call being to God, not to that congregation somewhere. And what this woman has been saying about, you know, I've got a message I'm supposed to proclaim that has a kind of permanence to it regardless of who I'm talking to. And at the same time, we can't let pastors get away with just being incompetent either.
Well, and the congregation can destroy a pastor. It really can. I've seen it happen.
It seemed to me what you
asked. Okay. There's the line, Werner, Carol, Jim, and you, okay?
And one of the points you're trying to make, you know, what counts, at least in the ALC, you know, the pension program in the ALC is set up so that it definitely favors the pastor of a large congregation. I think it's most unfortunate. What the reason other than that is, I really don't know, but I think the ALC is there. But the pastor that serves a large congregation ends up with a large pension. And, you know, so naturally, if you're, you know, thinking of the future, you try to get to a place where your pension is going to be the greatest. And I think that's, you know, that's unfortunate that it's even set up that way, officially by the church. Secondly, in terms of evaluation, I know in this district that the call procedure was changed 2 years ago, and it's made it much more lengthy in order to go through the process, but it's an excellent evaluation process where the congregation is forced now to do an evaluation on what their ministry is all about, and what they would like to see in a pastor to carry out the ministry that they think is necessary, you know, for their particular situation. And it slowed down the call process, but it's really put into effect a very, you know, thorough evaluation. So I think that some of that is starting to take place now, where the congregation, the entire congregation, now has to get involved in that, whether they really like it or not. It's taken out of the hands of, you know, the one or two members that have made the decision in the past.
Carol?
I was going to say, I think that quite a few letters of call do describe the expectations of the congregation. And that, and granted, there are all kinds of generalizations there that don't really fulfill detail, any kind of detailed descriptions. But I think letters of call have improved. That's one thing. The other thing is that recently my church had all kinds of people in the congregation, both those that are considered leaders and anybody they can drum up on Saturdays, but not just people, do an evaluation of the pastor and the program of the church. And I thought that was really a good thing. I don't know where it came from. I can't remember the name of who did the survey. But I was struck it took a long time to fill out all these questions. I was struck by how many, many questions that I answered really failed to get at a real evaluation as to what the work was. And it ended up being a numbers game itself. The idea was good, but what it didn't get was whether the pastor could do something more to meet the needs of the congregation. For instance, it never said anything about whether the pastor was teaching people how to do, equipping the saints for the work. I mean, it just said, was the Sunday school teaching adequate, or were the sermons okay, or were the choir anthems, right? Those kinds of things. Did the ALC, the women's team. I mean, it didn't really get at what should have been evaluated, I guess what I'd like to say. Maybe testing procedures needed improvement in the church.
Jim?
I guess I just want to elaborate a little bit on my agreement with Jim's comment that we need communication, and that's happening here tonight, but I think we need it on a massive scale. I think it's either an indication of the presence and power of the Holy Spirit or something else that the church continues to go on in a situation where I think it's true that huge numbers of congregations are unhappy with pastors, and a huge number of pastors are unhappy in their situations. I teach at the Theological Seminary. I'm not at all proud of the job that we do. I think that some magnificent people come out of that school. I also think that we inflict people on congregations that we have no business inflicting on them. I think that there are many difficulties that are somehow inherent in the whole business of educating and training pastors. I think for one thing, there was a comment about the medical profession, and that may well be true, probably is true, but at least in the medical profession there is a public there's a public interest and a public certifying process. There are state boards. There are state boards for nursing. A plumber presumably has to, in order to get into the union, know how to get a pipe or whatever a plumber does. A dentist had better be able to show teeth or he doesn't get a license. But there is no public interest in certifying procedures for ministers, and perhaps there cannot be in this country, and there ought not to be. But you can be a minister by sending $25 into XYZ Minister Association, and there is no across-the-board certifying procedure. I think that's one problem. Another problem is that with the denominational setup that we have in this country, I think that's good. One of the negative features is that there is such a wide variety of notions of ministry and church and gospel and Bible and such that it's very hard to get all that together. I think another problem is that we're dealing with Christian faith, which is, for many people in congregations, hopefully, the single most important thing in their lives. And there is an enormous emotional load, and there ought to be, in reaction to the pastor and to the congregation. We're not dealing with hiring or firing a Girl Scout leader or something. We're dealing with the person that has to do with the most important thing in the world and in our lives, and that complicates things. I think another problem is that congregations are run by and large by volunteer people. That's one thing in the military or in business where you have a chain of command and you have job descriptions. Person doesn't do the job, forget it. But in an organization run entirely by volunteer people, that's very, very tricky job of administration. So I guess that I just think that I want to hop on what Gene says. I think that what we need in the church is a massive across the board attack on the question that we're dealing with tonight. I just today sent a letter back to our ALC Division for World Mission and Inter-Church Cooperation, agreeing to serve on an 18-person panel that will spend a year and a half discussing missionary vocation, because there are hundreds of missionaries around. Nobody knows what a missionary is. That's a bad scene. There are unhappy nationals. There are unhappy missionaries. Somebody has got to take the thing by the bit and or by the horn or whatever you take it by, and ask what is a missionary, and so they're doing it. And I think we need to do that in the church. I don't think the seminary, the congregations, the pastors' union, whatever, that there is no consensus on what a minister is, and we're going to be in a lot of trouble until somehow or another we work very hard as a church on that question and arrive at some kind of consensus so that we know what we're doing. We fly by the seat of our pants, and I think the time has come when we can't do that much longer. The Holy Spirit is getting weary.
Amen.